Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft.
Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. English 115F, Fall 2007, Vanderbilt University. Professor Jay Clayton, Professor Matthew Jed Hall. Visit our class blog at worldsofwordcraft.wordpress.com.
I will say that we keep getting people here in the IT coming up to us at lunch saying, we're listening to this class, it's amazing. And the big things they comment on is how smart the students are in this class. They were very impressed with you all last class period. You're going out on the internet. People are listening to you. It's very exciting. This is a great experiment. And of course, if there's something you've missed that in a class that you want to review, it's right there for you to rewind the lecture, listen to what people have said, figure out some procedure. If we start explaining something technical and you need to remember it, you can use this as class notes. So it's all there on the internet. Now, Matt was going to talk a little bit more about the blogs. Your first blog post is due tomorrow. So Matt wants to talk about
that. Datto and Spud Monkey have already blogged. I don't have everyone's account in the WordPress. The process, guys, it's in the fact. We discussed it this week. I want to reiterate it. I need your email address that you signed up your WordPress account on. I don't need you to get a separate blog. I mean, you can do that. That's optional. But as Spud Monkey and Datto illustrate here, we're going to be posting collectively to one blog, which is our worlds of WordCraft.wordpress.com. So again, send me your email address that you used to set up your WordPress account, and that will give you author permissions to the blog.
Question. I think I sent you my username.
That doesn't work.
But
I need the email you used.
I got an email from something that said I was an author.
If you're using your Vanderbilt.edu address,
yes,
I'll try that.
That's
first.
What I did.
Seth set up one of his like AOL. He used your AOL. We couldn't figure out why it wasn't working, so we sorted it out once he gave me his AOL address that he used in setting up the account. So.
Yeah, because I did get an email.
Yeah, Matt.
I keep getting to this screen. How do you add yours? If you click, when you're on your own domain, then you click on the Worlds of WordCraft 2007 fall, and then I can click on everyone else's, but how do you add your own?
There should be a button there on the tab that says New Post. And if you want to have a little conversation after class, I can demonstrate the mechanics of it so we don't tie up our discussion time in that. But see me after class if you have a moment.
So take a look up on the screen at Spud Monkey's post, and below it is Datto's post.
See the screenshot.
So, you know, that looks like a good blog. I was explaining to someone beforehand, before class, to Greg maybe, that not all of them have to be the same length. Both of those are good substantial blogs. Some weeks you might write less. Some weeks it might just be a paragraph. Some weeks you might want to write quite a bit. But what we'll be looking for is that you're engaged with whatever you're writing, that you've given us something that has some spark to it, that's intelligent, that just shows you're engaged with the process. So it's not about length, it's not about writing reams of material up on the board, but just something that's interesting and is engaged. So any questions about the blog? Excellent. So I understand that some people had a little trouble watching the movie here last night. Evidently, the movie didn't show up. Miscommunication. Someone had said they were going to bring the movie, didn't bring it. That would be you?
I would like to apologize. I said I would get it, but I didn't know. I mean, I talked to, I think...
What's your name again? Sorry.
Mike. And then I didn't think you were really sure, and I kept putting on Facebook, is everyone going to this? I didn't get any responses.
I responded, didn't I?
Yeah.
At any rate, okay, accidents happen. Thank you, Daniel. Accidents happen. This is not an emergency. Most of you all have seen this movie before. You're still responsible for seeing it again because I want you to have a close, detailed memory and understanding of the scenes as presented in this movie, not because we're going to be talking about the differences between the movie and the game and the movie and the book and all three. Yes, Daniel, again.
I still have it in case for people who haven't seen it, just put it on Facebook. I can give you the DVD because I rented it from Blockbuster and I can watch it.
So we can pass it around. So if you want to come get it from Daniel, email him, Facebook him, something like that, and grab a copy of it. Thank you for renting it.
I want to stop.
So I'll just go backwards here a little bit.
I'm starting.
Right. This
is
what so,
they're common backgrounds. Two freshmen girls.
You gotta have it on. And pause.
Fun with AV stuff.
That's right. So we're going to have a discussion about The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Rings, Volume 1, extended version of the Peter Jackson movie. Came out in 2001. It's one of the really great success stories of contemporary cinema. We watched this one because the Lotro, the game, is set during the first half of this movie. And what that has done for the makers of the online game is give them the opportunity for expansions that move on into the rest of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. But as you will see, once you have done your epic quest, you'll see that at the end of the prologue of your epic quest, which you can do, I guess there's an epic quest in each region. I did the epic quest in the Shire, didn't you?
Did
yours in Bree, and there is definitely one in Rivendell. You do your epic quest, the prologue, at the end of it, you all are sent to Bree, where you meet Aragorn. And Aragorn is there waiting for Frodo to reach Bree, as in the movie. And then he has to depart. And it's,
please continue. I just said, when you finish a thought, I'll ask a question.
It's very cleverly done that once you have completed book one of the epic quest, there's 10 books of epic quest that is where you're really participating in the Lord of the Rings quest itself, as opposed to doing little tangential stories. But when you reach the end of book one, Aragorn leaves Bree and says, I can't wait any longer for Frodo, gotta go. And you can no longer speak to Aragorn in Bree. So that they actually have figured out a way to sequence. We'll be studying this later in some of our readings, the difference between game time and live time, and how that, and here they're having to map on top of one another three temporalities, three time schemes. Game time, lived time, that is your time playing the game, and the novel's time scheme. And those are, it's a very complex set of arrangements that they have to sequence, and it's clever how they do it, at least at the end of book one. So that's something to look forward to. That's why we're both seeing the movie Fellowship of the Rings and reading that volume of the trilogy. I encourage you to see all three movies and read all three volumes if you haven't before. But in this class, we'll be studying those, because you will meet or see the locales just about many of the things in the movies and the books. Maybe not all of them, actually. So, the movie.
I did have a question.
Yes, your question.
What is the name of the inn that Frodo first encounters Strider?
Winds and Cone.
Pressing Pony.
Daniel got it.
Prancing Pony.
That's right.
And it's fun to see that Prancing Pony in the game and then see how it was represented in the movie.
I was really thrilled when I saw Midgewater Marsh in the movie.
Absolutely. I'm picking up things in the movie now because of living in the game a little bit.
Exactly. So I want to talk about the status of Lord of the Rings in a literature class. Now, this is maybe something that you haven't spent a lot of time thinking about if you're not literature majors. But why are we reading or seeing movies of a work like The Lord of the Rings? I often encounter skeptical people out in the community, perhaps parents, that are saying, you know, why aren't you reading serious literature? Why are you reading pulp or science fiction or something like that? Have you gotten that reaction at all? Yes?
I am.
From?
Any of my friends, well, just like when I tell them about this class, they're like, you're doing what? And I'm just like,
I think it's serious.
Well, I mean, we still do all the stuff you're doing in your first year writing seminar. We're just doing it over like a different subject.
Yes, that's correct.
Kind of, they kind of see the light, but
they feel like what? What do they feel like?
They feel like that, like, it's just kind of like a blow off class, and I'm getting like an easy A, and they're actually having to work hard.
Aha!
So they're jealous.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. Right. And a lot of them applied and didn't get in, so.
Well, we certainly hope this is not going to be a blow-off class, and we think you're going to work for your grade. But make them weep with envy, if you possibly can.
Encourage that sentiment.
Well, they are.
But what about other people? Are you hearing reactions about how is this material worth studying? You get that?
Well, my brother wants to come stand up now.
Excellent. Excellent. Yes. Well, you know, I've encountered that all my life. When I said I was interested in science fiction or interested in Lord of the Rings, and one thing that I think that a lot of people don't understand is that the Lord of the Rings is only the latest installment in a 2,000-year-old cycle of tales, the never-ending story that makes up the genre of romance. Have any of you all heard the term romance in a literary critical sense, romance as a genre? First of all, I guess let's back up and ask, what's a genre? Yes, Jonathan.
A specific type of literature.
Exactly. Can you give me examples of other kinds of genre?
Like romantic.
Now, romantic is a time period.
Drama.
Drama is a kind of genre, but usually they're a little more specific than all genre. Yes, Matt?
Like historical fiction.
Right, historical fiction's a genre. Yes,
Matt? Science fiction.
Science fiction's a genre.
Mystery or something.
Mystery, okay. Any more canonical ones? Fantasy is less canonical. Canonical meaning established and approved by the authorities, Matt?
Biographical.
All of those are genres. Probably the most canonical genres would be tragedy. Be a little more specific than just drama, you would divide it down to tragedy, comedy,
action,
satire. Action is a genre, but these are most of the ones you've named are so-called popular genres. Science fiction, fantasy, action. These are popular genres. They're interesting to me, and we're going to be studying them. But the more canonical genres like tragedy, comedy, satire, epic, the epic poem. Now, romance is generally a narrative work, used originally in poetry form, of extended length that was a modified form of the epic. Well, now, has everyone here had some encounter with an epic like the Iliad, the Odyssey, the Aeneid? Yeah. So, Beowulf, exactly. So you've had an encounter with that epic poetry, but romance is a little different. Romance as a genre is a little more of a narrative, a genre that indulges in narrative pleasure. It the characteristics of romance as a genre are vivid character types, very vivid character types, sometimes even allegorical character types, but rather abstract, so that, yes, Jonathan.
Would Hiawatha be romance?
Yes, Hiawatha is a romance. The Longfellow's poem?
Yeah.
That's right. That's a good example. Romances tend to have highly dramatic plots, very involved dramatic plots with rather stylized characters. So if you think about what people often value in a realistic novel, they often value very complex, psychologically interesting characters without a lot of plot. So if you think of romance as a genre, it pretty much flips that priority and gives you simple good versus evil. You know, Gandalf, Sauron. It gives you these, what you might even call stereotypical characters. That's why they fit into allegory so well, so that when you read an allegorical poem, the characters are abstract and fit a pattern, yes? So we're talking about romance a little still here. Those are some of the most prominent ones. The Arthurian cycle are all romance. Think about, Lancelot, Merlin, Sword in the Stone, all of those, Morte d'Arthur, those are all romance poems. Spenser's The Faerie Queene, which we'll be reading later in this semester, is a romance poem with a little bit of an allegorical element to it. Shakespeare's The Tempest is a play in the form of a romance. It has other elements in it that you'll recognize from Lord of the Rings, but also from these other examples. It's got lots of emphasis on folk elements, on magic. It has a kind of cyclical action pattern. You'll notice that the actions tend to repeat themselves. It's not, you're so used to a realistic novel where a single protagonist goes through his or her lifespan and learns something, and you value it because it's not repetitive. Whereas in romances, you'll see the same patterns occurring again and again, and what makes it interesting is the variations on the same thing rather than the kind of originality of the in-depth analysis of character. You'll notice that in romance fiction and literature, often you'll get duplicates of characters. We call those doubles. Have any of you all studied doubles before in class? Matt's nodding yes, which I appreciate. Could you talk about it? Do you feel comfortable talking about what a double is in literature?
Like a double character?
Yeah.
Just a character that's based off another character that has some of the same core characteristics as a predecessing character.
Exactly.
For instance, Gandalf, Merlin, you can see a lot of similarities.
Yeah.
Aragorn, King Arthur.
Right, very nice. So that a double inside a work of literature would be two characters in the work of literature that seem to be kind of versions of one another. Can you think of, does Gandalf have a double in the movie? Often a double will be an evil version of a good character. Well, not quite Sauron, Saruman.
So is it like a foil?
No, it can be a foil, but not always. Often you'll get, foil's not a bad point, but it's not always a foil. It's often a variation on a theme, so that you'll notice that in something I'm about to show you, that romances will not only have characters that kind of double one another, so that it makes the same point through a character in different ways, but you'll also have scenes or motifs that will, those are two different things, a scene that will kind of duplicate another scene in the movie. And if you're alert to it, you'll go, oh, I see, that's a second version of that same episode with a difference. It's always with a difference. So you actually learn something by the juxtaposition of two scenes that are similar to one another. All this is preparation for some scenes I'm going to show you in the Lord of the Rings movie, because the Lord of the Rings movie fits the quest romance pattern brilliantly. It is a quest romance. Now, a romance upon which a character goes on a quest is a quest romance. And most of these books that we've talked about can either are quest romances or they contain quests in them. You know, think about the Arthurian cycle. There's plenty of the Round Table sends all those knights out on the quest of the Holy Grail. So there's quests in them. It's pretty clear there's a quest in the Lord of the Rings. So what I would like to do is show you the quest romance cycle. First I will show you the way in which the movie draws on Arthurian romance. There on your left is a picture by John William Waterhouse from 1888 of the Lady of Shalott. And on the right is Galadriel, I believe, from the movie. And you can see that the makers of this movie were drawing really deeply on the Arthurian cycle and on artistic representations down through the centuries of the Arthurian cycle. So it's not merely that they're drawing on it for ideas and plot developments, but even for costuming. Now, here's the quest romance cycle. The typical quest romance begins in childhood. Generally, the character is an orphan, or in some other way, cut adrift on his own or her own. The main character of Book 3 of the Fairy Queen that we're going to be reading happens to be a shield maiden, a female knight who goes on a quest disguised as a male knight. So you can see that it can be he or she, but very often they're orphans. Can you think of obviously Frodo is on his own, an orphan. They usually have some kind of father figure or false father. Who's Frodo's father figure?
It's Bilbo.
Bilbo. Let's have, for the entire class, mapping onto this quest cycle, not only Lord of the Rings, but what?
Yeah, Star Wars.
Star Wars, exactly.
Luke Skywalker.
Luke Skywalker, an orphan, a father figure, and then a real spiritual father figure, Obi-Wan. So you see how they both start out that way with a surrogate. You can also map onto it features of the Bible, for example. There's lots of romance elements in the Bible. If you think of I'll talk about Moses in relation to the romance cycle as we go on along. The first stage of the cycle is leaving home. And in leaving home, there's almost always a moment of the threshold where the character has to reach a threshold, make a decision, am I going to go forward or am I going to stay in my supposedly safe childhood world? Always that childhood world is only apparently safe. You know, here, let me show you this clip from the movie. This is, of course, Frodo in his childhood world in the Shire, only apparently safe. These are going to be very brief clips just to illustrate my point. Now, the next clip is going to be Frodo and Sam leaving the Shire and reaching a threshold as they leave the Shire. Of course, the Shire is only apparently safe. In fact, you see in the Palantir that if he doesn't complete his quest, it's going to be destroyed. And our Star Wars analogy?
When he leaves
Tatooine. And is that farm only safe or not? You know, and that scene in Star Wars is particularly draws on scenes from a million westerns, where the boy that's going to go on the quest comes back to the ranch, which he's only left to go into town, and comes back and finds that either the villainous outlaws or the Indians or whatever group is going to be stigmatized as the villains have burned down the house and roasted his surrogate parents. You get that in the Star Wars scene. So now I'm going to play, a very brief clip illustrating, in this case, how literal the threshold is. I should ask, you all know what a threshold is?
Yeah.
Okay. But everybody's nodding yes? Okay.
This is it. This is what? If I take one more step, it'll be the farthest away from home I've ever been. Come on, Sam.
Tell me if that was a threshold scene or not.
Yeah. You can even see the difference in the color in the grass, too.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Like
gold
versus green.
So there it is, the leaving the Shire for their threshold. So they're setting out on their quest, and generally after they've crossed the threshold, you have to cross the threshold on your own, or in this case, the pair. But nonetheless, it's the two young hobbits are setting out on their own. But right after you cross the threshold and make the decision to begin, you meet up with a guide.
A trial.
We'll wait for our trial first. I was going to give him a guide. I was going to give him, Strider. a guide. So the next stage is what I'm calling initiation. I mean, we're going to read some articles that'll talk about the quest romance structure, and they're going to have different terms for this. There's no one set of ways to describe these phases, but I'm going to call this initiation. When the hero of this romance is really inducted into the job that he or she has to do and figures out what it is. And the clip I want to show you about it is at Rivendell. And generally part of being initiated is also feeling doubts about yourself. You know, am I worthy for this quest? I wish I didn't have to take this quest on. So at Rivendell, the first trial, between the threshold and initiation, I want to go back to Sess Point and say that he has added something to my circle. I would add that in. There is a big trial before getting to Rivendell.
The ring race.
The fight on top of Weathertop and the ring race, a location that, of course, you can visit in Lord of the Rings. And then the incredible, my favorite scene, I think, in the entire movie, and it's certainly my favorite scene in the entire book, the incredible race to the ford at Brunnen. And I did not put it on the tape because I didn't think we needed it. It would have just been purely for my viewing indulgence to show it. And in the movie, they make a crucial modification in that scene from the book. It's something we'll discuss when we read the book. But I want to show you Frodo at Rivendell and his doubts about whether he's going to take on this quest.
You've got mail.
No.
That's a different scene.
Mr. Shire, I spent all my childhood pretending I was off somewhere else. Off with you on one of your adventures. My own adventure turned out to be quite different.
I'm not worthy. I can't do it. I'm not up to it. This is a major motif in quests, romance, hero, and you get it again and again in the Bible. Moses, when called by the Lord to go and be a prophet, says, I can't do it. I stutter. How can I be a prophet? And Jeremiah says the same thing. Ezekiel says the same thing.
Saul hid.
What?
Saul hid whenever he
Saul
called.
Hid. The burden is too great. Are you raising your hand?
You're going to get an opportunity to do this interactively on a quest in Rivendell, taking a walk with Frodo.
That's right. That is so true. And by the way, when you get to Rivendell, you'll see that quest, and it'll be probably orange or red, meaning really hard for you. Take it. There's no fighting involved. You'll live through it, and
you get to have a chat with Frodo.
You get this neat
Frodo XP.
Get a lot of. So you get more XP. You get more XP. The higher the quest is relative to your level. So take it the moment you get to Rivendell.
But it illustrates his worthiness concept very well.
Love me up.
One of the, digressing about this game, one of the things about this game that I like is it's very hard to power level in the game. You have to do the quests. You can't just do it by grinding, if you know what that means, and those of you
just
that don't.
Just killing monsters repetitively.
That's right.
Unfortunately.
Killing. Right.
there's not really any botting that goes on.
So, let's see what I've got on here. Yes. The next phase is dedication to the quest, where you've said you're unworthy, but you commit to it anyway, knowing you're unworthy. And this scene, this clip here has 1, 2, 3 brief snippets linked together. So please excuse the choppiness of it, but you'll see it's going to be the council at Rivendell, of course. That's when they dedicate themselves to the quest. And then there'll be a minute of that, then it'll cut to another moment of the Council of Rivendell, and then it'll cut to a third moment of the Council at Rivendell.
Strangers from distant lands, friends of old, you've been summoned here to answer the threat of Mordor.
That may be my favorite.
And you, I was hoping you were going to cut that out.
Where are we going?
Well, Matt made a comment. I don't know if everyone heard this.
Yeah,
it's just if you look where they all stand.
Frodo is right in the middle, and then to the back of him, the right-hand man, Gandalf and Aragorn, and then to the left, which is who's seen as the underhand, was, what's his name, Boromir?
Boromir.
Boromir, who betrays him, but then comes back, but it's just kind of funny, all those little things.
Yep, it's very well done. And you have broadened out our discussion beyond just the motifs, the romance motifs at work here, to some of the symbolic meaning that you can see in a scene like this. Matt started that discussion. Let's continue that discussion for a bit. What else do you see in that scene? Yes.
Well, instantly, when they were all, to Arthurian kind of allegories, they're all in a circle.
Yes.
And they're all from different kind of walks, collecting in a circle. Circle rings, but circle also round table, circle trust. It all kind of bangs together.
Comes full circle.
Excellent. Excellent. Other things to say about it? That's starting us off well here. This is a very rich scene. I edited out the moment where he said, you know, we've the dwarfs, the men, the elves, talk about what all that seems to you to mean or evoke. Don't make Matt do all the work here.
Well, it also makes it apparent that the group is not perfect. That there's going to be strife and there's going to be struggle, even in between the members.
In fact, there's been a lot of it in this scene that we didn't see in the clip, but you saw last night, or you remember, you know, that Gimli's already saying, you know, I don't want to have anything to do with with elves. And
I'm not seeing anything in that.
Boromir's already moved.
Boromir is right. Think about the. Remember, I said that the characters are more like types than richly individuated figures. Now, these characters do have individuation, they do have psychological depth and subtlety, but they also remain types, don't they?
Are you static?
Well, not. So you're getting in this case, you're getting sort of the virtue of both. Psychological richness and typological significance. So, what do they stand in for?
You mean like,
pardon me?
Like, what do you mean? Like, what do they represent?
Yeah.
Like,
that's right. What do they represent? I'm trying not to make it sound like I'm asking for something too deep. I'm really, this is fairly. On the surface stuff. Yeah, follow out your thought.
The dwarves are like, kind of like the industrial race, and they're really gruff and blunt and to the point. And the elves are more like elegant, but still kind of snobby because they ain't comparing to everybody else. And then Boromir represents like the evil side of men, like the power hungry, and then Aragorn the opposite side. And then the hobbits are kind of like the giddy, playful, like, oh, what are we doing? Let's go. And then Gandalf represents like the wise old seasoned veteran.
That's just perfect, you know. Peter had his hand up.
I think of Gandalf more as like the mentor. And I think he almost groups it by a race sort of thing. Like Boromir and Aragorn, or while Aragorn is more, I guess, resistant to the taint of the ring, they're both like guides, and they're both sort of strong men, and they both act more hastily than the elves would. They both sort of go along the same line, except that Aragorn's good and Boromir's bad. In a sense. And then Gandalf's sort of the mentor, and he's his own race. And then the hobbits are sort of, I think, they're more representative of, like, love, I guess. They're brave only when, they're not brave at all unless something's going wrong with one of their party, in which case they'll risk their life to save someone.
That's right.
And they're small, but I think they're just sort of, they're very happy, they're very goofy, but they also have just sort of this deep dedication to everyone that they're with.
Excellent. So we'll go Michael, Greg, then you.
You could almost bring it back to like the Arthurian legends. You know, you have Aragorn.
The time is young.
Like I said, you know, Merlin and Gandalf. And then the others, you know, kind of have their allegories. It's been a while since I've read it, but you can also put like the dwarfs like Lancelot. I'm trying to remember the characters. Exactly.
You know, you're on something really good. But you don't want to be too one for one. It's romance always has these types that it varies. And so it's not a question of just mapping, okay, this character equal. You know, Gandalf does equal Merlin. There are a few like that. But basically, they're all romances, not just Tolkien's romance, will have the variants of these various positions. Okay, so that's a very helpful comment. Greg?
Well, I just wanted to make a comment, kind of going back to what Matt said, about, you know, Boromir is on his left. It's almost like a recreation of The Last Supper, Judas, like, because he betrays him. Like,
there's very much a kind of not Last Supper, but Christ and his apostles motif that occasionally crops up in around Boromir, Aragorn. The scene that I'm going to show you actually a little bit later, where Aragorn kneels down to Frodo and takes his hand and pushes it over the ring and said, "I would have gone with you to the end." You know, it's like a Garden of Gethsemane moment.
Yes.
Thank you. From that Christian cycle. Yeah. Wesley.
I was going to comment that was not Lord of the Rings written as an allegory to the Christian. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis wrote both their epics together as Christian allegory, not, you know, specifically, but with that in mind. And I also wanted to point out how I don't really think that the elves are so much snobbish. I think there is a purity, their purity of life, and that they're eternal, their purity in appearance, and everything about them is to the most excellent. The height, the features, their ability, and it seems like they represent an ideal.
So,
continue this conversation as a debate or a dialogue. You said elitist.
No, I was just saying, I think they more represent tradition, and that's why they have such sharp features, such hard. If you have sharp features, it kind of represents hard to mold, because they're already so rigid in the way that they think and things like that. And they're shorter, or I know he made them shorter than humans, because...
No, they're taller than humans.
Oh, okay.
So much for that.
You want to edit that out.
He can get edited. You don't get edited.
So, other views of elves? Yes.
They try to stay aloof, and that's a negative at some points. I don't think you can say. I mean, purity, like you were saying, they're pure, and that's true, but that's not always a good thing, because they're trying to stay pure from all the other races as well.
Right.
I want to go back to Wesley's point here briefly about the Christian allegory. C.S. Lewis was much more invested in the Christian allegory than Tolkien was.
Right.
There are ways to see Christian motifs in this book cycle and movie cycle, but there are also ways to see lots of different, that he was drawing on lots of different romance and myth and religious sources for this material. And so I'm not saying that's a wrong interpretation, I'm just saying it's not an exclusive one if you want to follow through those Christian motifs. Greg?
Well, I actually recall reading, and I don't know much about it, so I wouldn't be able to make the comparison, but I heard a lot of Norse mythology.
Exactly.
He was an Anglo-Saxon scholar.
He was an Anglo-Saxon and Old English scholar. There's a lot of Beowulf in this. There's a lot of Morte d'Arthur, the Arthurian cycles. There's some Spenser in this, the poet we're going to be reading. Lots of sources for it. But a little bit more about when this was written. Somebody that's got the internet up like you, find us the exact date of the Fellowship of the Rings.
Well, wasn't it pieced together over years? Like, it wasn't written as one body of work. I thought it was a bunch of different parts that eventually...
When was he writing
together?
All of, you know, at work? Mm-hmm.
Well, The Hobbit was his first.
Right.
And that was a story they told for his children, right?
Was that the story? Did we already get the date? It was July 24th, 1954.
54.
Post World War II.
But when was he writing the earlier stuff?
It says Hobbit was 37.
Right. So one point I want to make about this is that often romance will have a bit of a national epic to it. Matt was commenting on that
earlier when we were talking about what the different races kind of resemble.
Yes.
It can almost be traced to the different countries of World War II.
It can certainly be traced to World War II. Not that the dwarves represent somebody and the elves another group, but rather the necessity of the civilizations standing together to fight evil. Is very much Hobbit 37, yes?
Yeah, and the others were published in 54 to 55.
Right, but they were written earlier. So you, I want to illustrate how much this is on Tolkien's mind by another scene that at Rivendell, and I'm going to turn it on and then back it up a little bit so that you get the entire scene.
The time of the elves is over. My people are leaving in these shores. Who will you look to when we've gone?
The dwarves. They hide in their mountains seeking riches. They care nothing for the troubles of others.
It is in men that we must place our hope.
Men? Men are weak. The race of men is failing. Scattered and divided, leaderless.
There is one who could unite them. One who could reclaim the throne of Gondor.
He turned from that path a long time ago. His chosen exile.
Yes, man.
Oh, I was just going to say, the elves definitely represent the British.
Elves being snobby.
I was just saying it more because at the beginning of the war when they were getting bombed and they needed, at the turning point, they needed someone to come help them.
Tolkien's a British writer. He's not going to make that.
You don't think?
No, I don't think so.
You don't think? And then he calls the mayor.
I think that's the danger of over-allegorizing.
If anybody, I would have said it was the U.S. because they're reluctant. They're kind of reluctant to enter into the war like at this stage of the game. They need something to kind of prompt them.
Yeah. Or you can say sometimes a cigar is just a cigar, guys.
Right. So, still in this phase of dedication to the quest, I want to show you one of these scenes now that doubles an earlier scene. I'm going to show you a scene of Aragorn saying, "I don't want the burden of the quest." We've seen Frodo say, "I don't want it, take this cup from my lips." I want you to see Aragorn do it, so that you see, begin to see this repetitive structure of romance. Romance is one reason people think it's people that condescend to romance think it's not a serious genre because they'll point to things like, yeah, it just repeats itself, but rather it repeats itself with variations so that each time you see it, it feels deeper and more resonant. So watch this scene still in Rivendell.
The skill of the elves can reforge the sword of kings, but only you have the power to wield it. I do not want that power. I have never wanted it. You are the last of a bloodline. There is no other.
Now you've seen it three times. And that's not a flaw. It's built in, it's part of the repertoire of romance that it works this way. Now, the next phase of romance is the journey to the underworld. They quests almost always takes you to the underworld. Can you give me some examples from other epics? Anybody?
Odyssey.
Death Star. Or Dagobah.
You know, Dagobah. Right, that's the planet where
Yoda
takes young Luke Skywalker down into the underworld. Exactly. Yes. So we got Dagobah. Is that it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the Odyssey. The Aeneid. Mm-hmm. Aeneas has to go to the underworld.
Beowulf.
Paradise Lost.
Definitely Paradise Lost.
I'm not sure if he's going back. He does go back.
The whole point is the underworld, is that? Or not quite the whole point. If you think about, again, just to parallel to Christians, the Christian story, when, for those of you that aren't Christians, I will recapitulate the story so that you'll know about this. When Christ is crucified, on the third day he rises from the dead, and he goes and harrows hell. That is, he goes down into the underworld and gets all the people that died but were good prior to his coming and brings them with him back up out of the underworld. So you can see that same structure there as well. Well, of course, the underworld scene in Volume 1 is the Mines of Moria. Exactly.
This, my friend, is the home of my cousin Valio, and they call it a mine. A mine! This is a mine. It's a tomb. And I have but one choice. We must face the long dark of Moria. Be on your guard. There are older and fouler things than orcs in deep places.
There's, I think, a moment that... Oh, one point I want to make before I go on to the next clip. This scene of the journey to the underworld is repeated in movie 3. What scene?
Where they go to get the souls of the dead.
Exactly. Remember in Aragorn, the dwarf and the elf go take the passage through the mountain that to get the souls of the dead and make them redeem their promise. That shows you that both on a microcosmic level and a macrocosmic level, the structure of romance repeats itself, so that you'll have repetitions inside each volume, and then you'll have repetitions over the volumes, so that the harrowing of hell takes place again in the final volume of the three books. So I thought I'd show you the harrowing of hell. That would be the journey into the underworld, and I'd give you a little harrowing in this next scene.
You cannot pass! Get out! I am the serpent of secret fire, yielder of the flame of our Lord. Dark fire will never fail you, flame of Udon!
Shadow. You shall not pass.
fools.
Counterbalancing the initiation on the initial journey out from childhood is the scene of temptation in the latter parts of the quest. And again, you see people tempted over and over again. I'm going to show you a clip. We're actually running short of time. We've got 10 minutes left, so I want to get on through this. So I'm going to show you, move right into it, a clip that will make the point about the role of the temptation of the hero in this romance cycle.
Take it!
No, no.
You must take it!
You cannot offer me this ring!
I'm giving it to you!
Don't! Tempt me further! I dare not take it. Not even to keep it safe. Understand, Frodo. I would use this ring from a desire to do good. But through me, it wields a power too great and terrible to imagine.
If you ask it of me, I will give you the one ring. You offer it to me freely.
Those who fail the test always
end up. And you will beg for death before the end.
He redeems himself.
Oh, it's moving how he redeems himself. It's so moving. His death is incredible.
Spoiler alert on the on the iTunes.
This is the most important line. I cut the most important line. Frodo, what have I done?
Yes, what have I done?
What have I done?
I swear to you, I will let the Red City fall.
Excuse me. I don't want this scene. I was so perturbed that I cut the most important line, which is, what have I done?
He said it.
Just barely. Okay. It's like, what have I done?
What have I done? But that was the point, yes. Can you think of temptations in religion or myth?
Braveheart the movie, you know?
Mm-hmm.
A little temptation is, or I guess a big temptation is at the end whenever he's about to be tortured and then killed, she tries to give him a little potion so that he won't feel it or whatever.
That is a great reference, Braveheart the movie. Braveheart the movie is based on, though not taken directly from Sir Walter Scott, and Sir Walter Scott is probably the greatest writer of romances of the 19th century. And so it is a romance. Braveheart is a romance, and you identified a great example. Yes.
Star Wars with Luke and his confrontation, but meeting up with Darth Vader. Join me on the dark side.
Yes, come over to the dark side, Luke. Yes, Daniel.
It's been a while since I've studied Macbeth, but that scene and right there, that kind of reminds me of Macbeth. One of his soliloquies, I'm not really sure, where he kind of breaks down.
So a lot of Shakespearean influences in Tolkien. I don't have at my fingertips the scene you're thinking of either, but it wouldn't surprise me a bit.
It may be too, because I think I might have seen a movie where he played Macbeth too. So
it might be a little.
Yes, sir.
The Forbidden Fruit and Pandora's Box.
Yes, yes. And what about the devil coming, Satan coming to Christ out in the desert and offering him three temptations that Christ had to refuse prior to coming back down into civilization. So that's the temptation. The next phase, there is another phase here, which is right before the climax. There is a moment of recognition where the hero recognizes himself or herself as the person he or she is. In other words, accepts his destiny. Says, yes, you know, unworthy though I've been, I am the person that is chosen to do this. So that the romance cycle becomes a journey of maturation at the same time that it's an adventure story. You've gone from childhood through initiations, you've had a guide, you've gone through ordeals, you've been tempted, and then you recognize yourself as your own identity. So the recognition scene I want to show you was the one. First, I want you to see Aragorn, who's been trying to say, I don't want to be king, saying, I will be king. And then the last scene of Frodo recognizing himself as the ring bearer. Well, just after. I mean, it could have been that one too, yes.
I do not know what strength is in my blood, but I swear to you, I will let the White City fall. Our people fail. All the people.
So he's horrible. In the final scene of the movie. Wesley has said it could have been, I could have chosen the scene where he goes into the boat, you know, where clearly Frodo's recognizing, I have to do this alone.
Or when he's sitting there and Merry and Pippin are like, come over here, and he's like, oh, yeah. I have to leave.
That's right, he's leaving. Now I want to make two quick last points. Look up at my diagram. Romance is an action genre. It's all about action and adventure and quests. If I turn this off,
press DVD or something, then I'm muted.
There you go. Thank you. But within it, it's punctuated frequently by lyric interludes, moments of poetic calm or quietness. The hurly-burly action pauses, and if you're a young reader and you're in it for the adventure, you often want to skip those parts. But, you know, clearly the time, the interlude at Rivendell, and then again the interlude at Lothlorien are static, unmoving moments of rest. And they are all through romance as a genre. And then finally, I wanted to show you that we had that opening threshold, but the notion of a threshold moment is repeated three times in this movie. There's the threshold of Sam saying, "I've never taken a step out of the Shire." What are two other vivid thresholds?
When it's only in the extended version, but when they walk through as the Fellowship and. Yeah, so do I go left or right?
Yeah, and it's right through.
And there is an actual threshold.
Right through the threshold door. That's a great one. We're now up to a count of four other thresholds. No, it's a great one. I love it when you say something I hadn't thought of, and you've now taught me something. Yes?
Well, and the threshold on the mountain, and they choose to go into the underworld.
And
into the ground.
Because we have no more time... We've got to go. Let me just say the two river scenes. You know, the crossing into the ford, that's a threshold moment, and then the crossing of Frodo and Sam into Mordor. Okay. Thank you all.
Thank you.